And one of the students came to train at our gym and said, these guys were saying this about you. Now, anybody else would have been like, yeah, whatever. I don't give a shit what they say. But my coach was like, what? Buddy, they talk about us, buddy. Gonna go smash, buddy.
What's the most efficient path to victory against this particular opponent?
He's dropping off the choke here. We could see the finish. It's looking tight. Tyler Delpre.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Everyday Jiu-Jitsu Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Kwan. Everyday Jiu-Jitsu Podcast is everything you need to know about jiu-jitsu. And today I have a guest with me, Mr. Todd Fox. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you coming here. So, Todd, you have a very extensive list of accomplishments and achievements in life. But I couldn't list them, but I think I'm just going to give you the floor and ask you, who are you?
My name is Todd Fox, from the U.S., from St. Louis in Los Angeles. Started martial arts about 10 years old and started with traditional stuff like karate and a little bit of judo and a lot of wrestling, and went in the Marines, served all over, specialized in Latin America, went to recruiting duty in the Marine Corps and ended up training right next to a gym that taught Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. A guy had just come, a Hicks and Gracie black belt named Rodrigo Vaghi, had just come to St. Louis and was teaching. I went over there to check it out and got the standard ass kicking and started training Jiu-Jitsu. At the same time, well, just previous to that, I had started a protection business while I was in the Marine Corps. And probably what we're best known for is not the military side of things, but the high-profile celebrities that we deal with. And then kind of later in the game, I started writing books on the subject, fighting and military and law enforcement and martial arts and all that kind of stuff.
Wow. So you're also previously you've competed in MMA and jiu-jitsu as well.
Yeah, during my time, because I'm old, they called it NHB or no holds barred. So that was the kind of predecessor to MMA. So I was fighting in the mid 90s into the early 2000s.
How old are you?
50.
So you're an ex MMA fighter. You're a jiu-jitsu fighter. You've competed in jiu-jitsu. I saw you've won some titles too. What titles have you
won? Yeah, so I'm still competing in jiu-jitsu. I mean, as you know, because it's age and weight specific. It's very different than MMA, so you can kind of take the wear and tear of it. So national champion, Pan American medalist, you know, all the stuff from IBJJF to NAGA to AGF to you name it. So I'm still pretty active with that. It's just based on my schedule, depending on kind of where I'm at in the world. We're operating in about 151 countries, so it's difficult to kind of pin it down. But like I would say this year, I'll probably get 3 or 4 IBJJF tournaments in, and then I'm trying to do an AJP because I've never done one of those.
Sweet. So yeah, active jiu-jitsu competitor, ex MMA fighter, author, Marine. So you own a security firm. That's a pretty impressive list. How often do you train jiu-jitsu? Just curious.
Pre-competition, like if I'm home from overseas, normally I'll train 5 days a week. So it's just dependent kind of on injuries. And as you know, you get older, kind of you're nursing other injuries, not even the injuries you have in the moment, but stuff you've done before. And so managing that and recovery and a schedule and dealing with problems overseas, usually it's about 5 days of a week. It's like Monday, Tuesday, off Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, off Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And so you were a Marine. Were you deployed in Iraq?
No, I was in Iraq, not as a Marine, actually, after the Marine Corps doing protective service operations. So high threat protective ops. So you take high profile people or dignitaries into the zone to do whatever it is they're going to do. But while I was in the Marine Corps, no, Iraq wasn't happening.
Mm-hmm. This might be an ignorant question. When you go and protect somebody overseas, is that like a government funded operation? Like the government funds you?
Yeah, it can be. So yeah, so there are different ways, right? So the thing you're probably thinking of is through the State Department, and they do the high threat protective ops there. And that's a program called WIPS, WPS, Worldwide Protective Service. So they hire you as a contractor to the State Department. It can be to anybody. It can be to DOD. It can be anybody. And then you can be hired by private sector. Let's say it's a non-governmental organization. Let's say it's Doctors Without Borders, or it's a business group. Let's say it's, some type of Wi-Fi group. So they can hire you privately. So you can be hired by any entity, and there's no governing body other than the actual state, meaning the nation state, that controls when you come, when you go, if you can have weapons, if you can't have weapons, stuff like that. And also, visa wise, like if you go into the north of Iraq, like Erbil, you don't even need a visa if you're an American. Whereas if you go to Baghdad, you need a visa to get in. So, just depends on who you're working for and what you're doing. The last little bit that I did was for a private entity who was going in to do some type of charity type work.
So when you go overseas and you're operating in your protection firm, or let's say you were on the battlefield as a Marine, how has jiu-jitsu and martial arts helped you?
Well, I think jiu-jitsu in general is great because you learn to struggle, right? Like you're going to attack me, you're going to come after me, and I have to deal with what you're doing. And if any time I just stop and rest, I'm done. So it's a constant struggle. You're fighting to basically take ground, just like in any type of combative situation. You want to take ground and you want to keep it, and then you want to move forward. And so I think the conditioning of jiu-jitsu is mostly mental, right? It is as physical as it is. It's the mindset, right? It's the conditioning of, okay, I'm under stress. I've got to deal with this issue. And at the same time that I'm dealing with this issue, I've got to find a way to move forward in the chaos. And so I think there are a lot of correlations there between those two things.
Can you say that there's been a time when you've been in the field in either career, when you're overseas, where you've used grappling effectively, or is it mostly like other means of combat?
Yeah, no, grappling as well, because you have to think about things. Sometimes things are in like low profile situations where you're wearing normal clothes and you're operating under the radar, and that kind of stuff, you don't want to draw attention to yourself. So you would end up quicker in some type of close combat, meaning not CQB with firearms, but just close proximity to somebody where you're trying to manage or handle them, whether it's getting them in a car, getting them out of a car, trying to move them somewhere, or dealing with two or three people at the same time and getting a friend to take your principal or a coworker to take your principal out another way. So yeah, jiu-jitsu is probably more applicable from that perspective than some type of uniformed conflict, right? So low profile, 100%. Very, very common.
Excuse me. Adding on to the low profile thing, let's say you had to go to Baghdad to do an operation and you needed to fit in like plain clothes and whatever. I mean, for those just listening, they can't see that you're like, a well-kept white dude, your blonde hair. I can't tell your eye color, but you kind of fit that profile of like blonde hair, blue eyes, clean shaven. What would you do to sort of fit into a situation like that? Would you grow a beard? Would you wear fake?
Yeah.
What would you do?
Yeah. Blending is a big part, right? So you can do a lot of things to blend. Like I can grow a beard. I can use dye in my beard. I can use dye in my hair. I can put brown contacts in, I can wear clothing that the locals wear. I can limit my speaking, right? And I can blend into groups of people who are locals or indigenous, and then it'll be harder to pick me out, right? It's possible, but it's harder than it is right now as you talk to me with, blonde hair and blue eyes, or gray hair and blue eyes. So that's very possible, but it's really knowing where you can go and where you can't go and who you can go there with and how you can kind of piggyback on the flow of life in that culture, right? So, if I'm in a Christian nation, like Sunday's the day off, the worship day, whatever. If I'm in a Jewish one, it's Saturday. And if I'm in a Muslim one, it's Friday. And so knowing kind of how these things flow and how they move, and it could be simple stuff, right? Like maybe in Canada or in the US, we walk directly up to a woman and start talking to a woman. You don't do that stuff in the Middle East. That's not how it works, right? You go to the man that's with them. Even if it's a 12-year-old boy that's with them, that's who you go to, as opposed to say the 30 or 40-year-old woman. So part of it is looks, but part of it is blending in culturally, socially, like how they do stuff and just accepting kind of the norms for how business works or functions in that spot or space.
So it sounds like whenever you go into one of these spaces, you have to do some research, do some homework on the culture and see, you know, make sure you don't offend anyone so that you don't stand out or do anything silly, blow your cover. So as somebody who has been, you know, a Marine, who stepped into no holds barred fighting, jiu-jitsu competition, I mean, it's very impressive just the things that you've done. Does anything get more stressful for you than like battlefield, like being in a war zone? Would you say that that is, you know, where in life you've experienced the most amount of stress?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, any type of thing that you feel unprepared for is what creates that emotion, right? Where you feel that anxiety. And, you know, even to this day, still competing, if I'm going to a tournament, I can have way more experience than everybody, but I'll still have anxiety. I'll still feel butterfly in my stomach and know that that's coming. And as time goes on, you kind of learn how to work that stuff out. I know it's going to set in. It's going to be this time, right? It's going to be X amount of time before the event. It's going to be when they say X thing, you know, all the way up to the time you slap hands or, you know, the bell rings, I can feel nerves. And then when that happens, it's over, it's gone. And then you're into the fight. And so, you know, I don't know, you know, if that ever goes away. I think, you know, it's hardwired into us for survival purposes. So you should feel a bit of that, right? It's you responding to the environment. But people respond differently. I have guys who have extreme experiences, and then it's a small thing like getting a shot that sends them into a panic. You know, it's just kind of how you're wired and then what it is that sets you off. But I've not found a sure way of never feeling fear. I feel fear all the time. You know, it's because I realize that shit in my environment can hurt me. So I'm cognizant of that. And I feel this feeling because I'm aware I have skills, but I also know that my skills might not be enough. And then the other thing is the stress can come from something that I create. You know, maybe even you've had this before where you don't want to let your teammates down, right? And it's not a fear of losing because I think the world's going to end if I lose a jiu-jitsu match, but you know, I don't want to let the guys down that look up to me, or the guys down that I trained with who put, you know, amount of time or effort into me, stuff like that. So fear is a weird thing. I mean, 30 years of working with it, I haven't found a way to conquer it. I've only found ways to manage it, right? Recognizing kind of the patterns and how it works and how to kind of calm it down and how to embrace it and say, okay, this is a good thing. I got this feeling. This is where we're at in the timeline. This is exactly where it should be. And now I'm moving on.
So that brings me to my next question, which is what can anyone do to improve their ability to manage nerves or stress during a conflict, whether they're, you know, a seasoned competitor or an untrained person dealing with some kind of a conflict that's in front of them? What can somebody do to improve their ability to manage those nerves?
I think the first thing that you do is on the front end, which is that you analyze what it is, whatever your mission, your goal is, and you learn everything you can about it. Okay, I know I'm doing masters, you know, IBJJF, it's a 5-minute period. So I need to be training 5-minute rounds, right? So I get used to that timeline. I know that when I go to IBJJF, I'm going to, you know, get an email ahead of time and I'm going to get a little, you know, code and, you know, whatever it is, I'm going to go check in at the door. If it's a bigger event or if it's not, I'm just going to go straight to the pen and, you know, they're going to check my gi. And I know what the process is, right? Like all these steps, I'm going to go check in. They're going to check my gi. They're going to check my weight. There's going to be a wrangler that, you know, mat 10, they're going to take us all to mat 10. I know that there's X amount of time in between rounds. I know what the point is. So I learn everything there is to learn about it. So I don't have these weird things that I don't understand that give me anxiety. Then after that, I'm training specific to that in those specific time zones. So everything in training is just like it's going to be in reality. And then when you get to like, I'm having these feelings, I think for most humans, the number one thing is breathing, right? Slowing your breathing down. Now people might call it combat breathing or box breathing. You know, we used to do it in terms of fours, right? So you breathe in for 4 seconds, you hold it for 4 seconds, you breathe out for 4 seconds, you hold it for 4 seconds, and you keep that cycle going. And so, you know, when I was on a SWAT team, a tactical team in the military, every single entry, I would do that for 2 to 3 minutes before the entry just to calm myself down so I can make good decisions. I had last weekend a tournament in Houston. I happened to be there. One of our clients was playing at an amphitheater there, and I went to visit the client, and I just said, screw it, I'm going to do this tournament. And slowing the fight down was huge because I had a guy that was super aggressive and wanted to go crazy and spaz. And that breathing and slowing things down kept me in the zone to make good choices and not rush out of anxiety. So I think the simple answer to your question is learn how to breathe to calm yourself down and relax. And then the other thing that some people do, and you see this with a lot of high level guys, is they have a ritual, right? Of when they show up, of what kind of music they listen to, of when they drink their water, of when they do their stretching. This routine helps keep them calm.
What weight division do you fight at? This is the Houston Open, right?
I'm middleweight. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What weight class are you?
I'm middleweight.
Okay, so am I.
I've been middleweight for 30 years.
Okay, I used to be a lightweight, and then now I'm a middleweight. How tall are you?
I'm 5'10".
Yeah, I'm a little bit short for that division for sure. How did you do? Just curious.
I took second in that one, so it was kind of a lackluster for me. In the finals, I had a 0-0 and lost a ref's decision. So my history has been pretty much submitting, right? Like I win 9 out of 10 matches. I submit 65% of the time. And to be fair, if I don't submit, you know, my chance of winning goes down pretty good because I'm submission focused. I'm not really a good point jujitsu guy, right? Not good at winning by advantage, not good at winning by 2 points. My game and my mindset is focused on submitting. And if that doesn't happen, if I've got a guy that plays kind of a stall type game or a really defensive game, you know, I know what I'm going to get. So that's what happened to me this past weekend. And it's kind of part of the game. You're playing a sports game. And if you don't play to the game, then you're going to succumb to some of the rules.
Oh, for sure. And I think IBJJF does just the way the rules are. Anyone who listens to the show knows that I think this is that it almost, I'm not going to say that it rewards passivity, but it's advantageous to be passive at certain times to win, whereas ADCC is the opposite. It rewards initiations. Have you competed in ADCC? Do you compete in no-gi competitions as well?
Yeah, I do no-gi as well. I haven't done ADCC for quite some time. It used to be, and this is probably before your time, the ADCC was by invite, even for the trials, it was by invite. Now that's a little bit different, but yes. And I've also gone to Abu Dhabi and been a guest there and trained and had access to the sheikhs and had some great training sessions. There've been in a room there where, you know, we have 75 black belts who are high level guys training, and, you know, it's amazing what they've done for the sport's phenomenal. It's a great model.
Why do you compete?
Personally, for me, it's more of just a test, right? Like I don't see jiu-jitsu as so much a sport, but the way that it works for me is if I go in and I go against somebody who's close to my weight, close to my age, close to my size, right? Like just in general, and I push it against them, they push it against me. It kind of tells me not only where am I at, but also like, how am I going to manage something new, something different, some type of surprise, right? The guys you train with, you kind of know their game and they know your game. And not to say that you can't change positions or change things up in training, but it can get stale. And so you don't really know where you're at. Also, when you're with friends, it's very different than when you're competing, right? Very, very different levels of aggression and kind of the feelings that you're managing at the time and working within very specific rule sets. You know, I don't care for tournament rule sets, but it also helps me because it limits me, right? So if I'm used to training or fighting or working with gear on, let's say guns and knives and vest and stuff like that, and all of a sudden I don't have that, that changes things. Let's say I'm used to working in a t-shirt, now I've got a kimono on, that changes things. So having these changes in rule sets, I think, helps me. So dealing with the stress, dealing with, you know, something like making a weight at 50 years old, that's a good thing, right? Because I have to manage what I'm eating and how much I'm training, and I have to manage my water intake. I think there's an endless number of things that make competition great. Doesn't make jiu-jitsu more realistic at all. In fact, I think it takes it away from reality, but it does a lot of good things for the individual from my perspective. And those are just a few things that I've noticed I gained from that.
Couldn't agree more. You had mentioned that your style lends more to like a submission style and that you get a lot of submissions. What's your most common or favored submission in jiu-jitsu?
chokes, 100% chokes.
Like any chokes or types, like
whether they're
in front, behind.
I would say probably usually from the top, half guard top or mount or cross side. But I would say like highest finish rate is probably with an Ezekiel.
Really?
And I mean a no-gi Ezekiel. Yeah, no-gi Ezekiel over everything. Even with the gi on, I don't use the gi for the Ezekiel. I use my arms.
Oh,
so.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay, let's change topics. Let's talk. Actually, before we do that, you had answered the question about how can like a trained person manage their stress. What about like an untrained person who, you know, let's say they're conscious enough to think about like, okay, there's a chance that I could be walking down the street and someone could walk up and try and fight me. And so this untrained hypothetical person is thinking, okay, what is something I could do in the future that even though I don't know shit, if somebody was attacking me, you know, what can like the average person do, low hanging fruit, maybe to just be able to make better decisions in a split second in a conflict or to have better reactions during a stressful conflict situation?
Yeah, I think I'll answer that kind of the same way in terms of structure, which is the best way is always prevention, right? Action beats reaction. And when you look at people getting attacked, they're reacting, right? The bad guy's picking the time, the bad guy's picking the place, the bad guy's picking the method of attack, and they're picking what? The response. So they're on their heels, and that's not the time to fight. So what I would say on the very first part of that, and I know this isn't your question, but to be very specific about how you solve these types of problems is you do your research. You don't go to the place, let's say it's this, you know, neighborhood X, and you especially don't go to neighborhood X alone, and you especially don't go to neighborhood X at 10:30 at night or 11:30 at night on a Saturday night. And you especially don't go to neighborhood X on this day of the week at that time of day into this specific bar. So you start to remove those things. And then, you know, the probability of that occurring is reduced drastically. And then you start to say, how do I have force multipliers? And that's, you know, by having friends with you or by having tools, which can turn into weapons. And then after that, you start to get into things like awareness, right? For example, if I have earbuds in, I'm taking away one of my senses. I can't hear what's going on, right? Or if I'm staring like target fixated at something, I'm missing all of the things in my peripheral vision, right? And if I start to get too excited or overwhelmed, what happens is I'll start to get tunnel vision. And now I'm missing all of this. I start to get auditory exclusion. I stop hearing stuff. So being able to have some type of awareness of the environment, and I think now probably you'll hear situational awareness as a buzzword, but that's pretty critical because if you can identify it early, just like in jiu-jitsu, I know you stick your hand in my collar and it's your dominant hand, you're 50% of the way there, right? So I need to control the other hand, or I need to control that hand and be aware that that other hand's coming. It's preventative. If you let them get all the factors or variables in an equation, they're going to get to that outcome. So controlling those things is huge. Then once you start having a plan in place, that will calm you down a little bit because you're not caught off guard as much. And then if you're aware, you're caught off guard even less. And then when it happens, you know, you have some type of plan in place that hopefully you've practiced. That's the biggest thing, right? With normal people that don't train is because they're not training when it happens, they're not used to those feelings. They're not used to those sensations. Whereas guys that train jiu-jitsu, boxing, wrestling, Muay Thai, real combat sports, they're used to that. They're used to that feeling. They're used to that conditioning that occurs in training. And so when it happens on the street, it's not a shock for them. It's something that they're well familiar with. So my answer to your question would be, first and foremost, figure out where you're going and what you're doing, reduce exposure. And when you do that, you're reducing your liability and probability, and then have force multipliers with you, have a plan in place. You know, if you have tools like weapons, even environmental weapons, I have glass and I have all kinds of stuff that I can utilize in my immediate area right now. A lot of things, even, you know, sitting right next to me. But the biggest thing is your mind, and the biggest thing is the early ID, right? Everything comes from your brain. There's nothing like, think about jiu-jitsu. It's your brain. If that's not functioning right, you're done. It's nothing's going to work, right? It's not just the physicality. So conditioning your brain, expecting things, looking for things, even positioning yourself and what you can see and where you can go and what you can do is going to increase your probability, not just of survival, but of thriving in that environment. So I think that's the big part. And then Second to that, know that you're going to have a physiological response to stress, right? Don't let that shock you. When shit hits the fan and you start having these feelings, embrace it. Say, yep, I knew this was coming. I was ready for this. All right, no problem. I'm going to slow the breathing down. I'm going to scan and assess my environment. I'm going to look for an opening to get out of. I'm going to look for weapons of opportunity. I'm going to look for force multipliers or people that are going to help me. I'm going to put a big mass between me and the threat. Having those kinds of plans and strategies in place and training them is critical to survival for anybody if you're talking about potentially lethal confrontations.
I assume whenever you leave the house, you know, you're you're going to Walmart or whatever. There's never a time when you're unguarded, right? Like you're always looking around. It just naturally, is there ever a time when you, when you're unguarded and you're just like, oh, I can relax now when you're out and about, maybe with the fam or with, or are you always like tactical?
I'm not paranoid. I'm prepared, meaning that it's built in, right? Like where I'm parking, how I'm parking, where I'm walking, how I'm walking. Those things are built into it. Am I more relaxed than, say, being in the Middle East? Yeah, of course. Or being in parts of South America? Absolutely. I'm more relaxed. So I think that has to be commensurate with the environment, right? Like you can't be laying in bed looking around. That doesn't work. You need to sleep. You need to recover. You need to rest. So you have to go in and out of these phases. Just like, you know, if you're training jiu-jitsu and you're training with a 10-year-old kid, you don't train the same way you're training with a heavyweight world champion, right? And if you're training with a 60-year-old man, you don't train the same way that you do with a 20-year-old, you know, NCAA All-American wrestler. They're different. You have to adjust to your environment, especially if you own a gym or a school, or especially if you're a leader. So you have to adapt to that. And so I adapt to my environments, but certainly given 30 years of exposure to something, you know, I am guarded in general, and I am more kind of aware of my environment and probably even more, I don't want to say pessimistic, but just, you know, looking for the openings and opportunities that are created by bad things and then, you know, adjusting to it. But certainly more relaxed at home than I am anywhere. And, you know, I would advocate for that because you got to rest at some point.
I think maybe you've already answered this next question previously, because we're talking about survivability and how we can, you know, increase force multipliers, et cetera, be aware of your surroundings. But my next question was like, what are some things that anyone can do to improve self-defense when dealing with conflict or when they're traveling overseas? Have you already answered that pretty much, or would you add anything to
what you said? But we can talk about it. Well, let's just change the context, right, to what you said last, which is overseas, right? Let's say you're going, whether you're going alone or with friends or with family, you're going overseas. You can be anywhere, like you're going on vacation to Mexico, right? And you know that crime is much higher there and much more violent there, in many cases than it is in the US, although there are cities in the US that are worse than Mexico. But let's say you're going there. So knowing where you're going, let's say, you know, you're going to this city in this hotel. So you got to go from the airport to the hotel. That's a ground movement. So what kind of ground transport are you taking? Is it safe to take a taxi? Do you know anybody there? Can you take an Uber? Is there at least like one layer of vetting with an Uber versus a taxi? You know, let's say it's Mexico. You know, all the taxi drivers are working for cartels in most cities. You know, do you want your information going out, especially if you look like you have something, or especially if you look like you're vulnerable? And while you're not very rich, let's say where you live, when you go there, you're perceived that way, right? So, you know, you may become a target quicker. So knowing stuff like that, right? Like, where am I coming in at? What do you have to move through when you leave the hotel? Actually, go ahead.
Would you, so two questions real quick. First of all, would you, let's say you're, taking your family to Mexico, doesn't really matter where it is. Let's say it's kind of like middle level danger. Like it's not super safe and it could be dangerous potentially. Would you recommend an Uber over a cab every time if possible?
Well, it depends on how you break it down, right? So one is, in terms of information, right? Like, what are the, what they call TTPs, or tactics, techniques, and procedures of the bad guys in Mexico? I have to know that ahead of time, right? So like in the US, it's not normal that a taxi driver would kidnap you, right? Or hold you for ransom, or they run scams that are very common. I've had this happen to people that I've worked with where, you know, you get in a taxi, you go somewhere and they take you to a different destination. And then someone else happens to carjack the taxi, right? Which is a guy working with the taxi driver. Mm. So those kinds of things are not common in America. So you have to know what the TTPs or the procedures or protocols or tactics of the bad guys are. And when you know that, you can start to make decisions based on that. So a lot of times Uber drivers, you know, they're not high level drivers and, you know, they don't have great vetting, but they have more vetting, right? As a general rule of thumb. And also they're planned. So meaning you're calling to somebody, it's going into a system. Whereas when you just walk out of an airport and jump into a random taxi, you don't have that same level of tracing that you would, mm-hmm. right? Or tracking that you would. Again, Uber is not super safe, but it may be the safer option. So, you know, you say if you're going with your family, right? I have to also think about that. What are the capabilities of my wife? What are the capabilities of my children? Are my children 5 years old or are my children 15? And let's say my 15-year-old, you know, is a high level competitor in Muay Thai and Jiu-Jitsu, or let's say, you know, they're in some type of prep program for the military. That's very different than if your kid's five, yeah. right? So when we talk about force multipliers, that kid can be there and supporting you. Also, it's just a physical deterrent, because if you have a kid and he's 5'10 and he's 180 pounds versus a five-year-old kid, that alone will deter, let's say, that taxi driver from taking action in your case, maybe. And if it does go south, at least you know you have somebody there that will fight maybe to the end if that's how you've trained your kid. So, you know, again, all the variables are pertinent, right? Like, what condition are you going to face? And that's kind of what you have to look at, right? Where are you staying? What are you doing while you're there? You know, what's it like from point A to point B? What's the political climate like when you're there, right? Well, how are Americans perceived, or in your case, Canadians perceived? That all that stuff adds up to create a good or bad or somewhere in the middle. And then you start to manipulate those variables to create the best possible scenario for you. So you're adding in, and then you're also removing stuff, right? Like, maybe I, as an American, take off my American flag and I put your Canadian flag on my backpack because you're perceived as being more docile and less of a threat. And doesn't mean you are. It just means that's the perception, generally speaking. Or, you know, in a foreign country, you know, where Americans are hated, I don't want to be flying that flag. It's probably never really a great idea to do that. So thinking about those things and those factors, I want to stack the deck in my favor, right? So I start to add these things in and I start to remove as much as I can. It could be something like not using dollars, right? American dollars. It could be something as not flashing my iPhone 27, whatever it is, or, you know, taking money out or gold out or wearing a Rolex or diamond rings, or, you know, starting to limit those things and then see how the locals dress, see how they move, see how they behave. And even if you aren't a local and it's obvious you're not, at least you don't stand out the same way, which means you're less likely to be selected for a target, because bad guys are looking to do a thing and get away with it, right? And so the faster they can do their thing, the less of a fight you are, the better for them, right? The higher the probability of them not getting caught is. And so they get a little, you know, reward, which is whatever you have on you, and then they move away. If they think they're going to have a fight in you, you're not a great target for them, right? So I'm starting to reduce the odds by what I wear, by how I move, by who I'm with. And sometimes it's just literally piggybacking on a group of people, right? Like you can roll up on a group of people and be walking right behind them or on the side of them and looking at other stuff and doing other things so they don't feel your presence too much. But from the outside, it looks like you're with that group of people. And maybe they won't attack a group of five people, whereas if you were by yourself, you know, you'd be more vulnerable. So all kinds of ways to manipulate your environment.
Very nice. I think maybe, again, you've answered sort of my next question, which is your MO when you go overseas, you know, Mexico, or let's say you were going to go into, I assume if you were going to go into like a war zone area, you would, if you were not going to be in a uniform, you would kind of want to fly under the radar as much as possible. But let's say you're going to Mexico or, I don't know, Dominican Republic, or, you know, and let's say it's a vacation. Would you just by default dress a little bit, you underdress a little bit, like not, you know, like you said, not showing the iPhone, maybe not flashing gold and jewelry. Would that be your recommendation?
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing to lose in doing that. And you're reducing your signature and you're reducing your value to a bad guy, right? So if I'm wearing, you know, jeans and a white t-shirt and some beat up flip flops, and I've got $20 in my pocket and one ID, I'm not really worth that much. And if they get that, it really doesn't change much for me, right? So you got to think about it from the perspective of, do you have something of value? Or maybe in some places it's you that holds value if somebody's willing to pay for you, right? In terms of kidnapping. But most of the kidnappings that are occurring, let's say in Latin America, the majority of kidnappings tend to be what we call express kidnappings, right? I'm snatching you up, throwing you in a car, and we're going to max out your credit cards and get whatever we can out of your bank account. And then we're going to dump you off. Or maybe they hold you for a short period of time, make some phone calls to some loved ones and try to get some money into an account and move from there. But, you know, targeted kidnappings tend to be for higher level, higher profile people, not average everyday citizens taking a vacation to Mexico or the Dominican. It's possible. It's not probable.
I don't know about you, but like, I mean, I run a jiu-jitsu school, so I'm constantly going back and forth to the gym. And when I get to the gym, we wear flip flops because I don't want to have bare feet off the mat. So it's just, you get into this like habit as somebody who trains jiu-jitsu every day to constantly wear flip flops. And the truth is when I see a dude in flip flops, I can't help but think about how vulnerable that is, because you can't really run. It's hard to fight. If your shoes fly off, now you're barefoot. The person you'll be fighting will most likely be wearing shoes. Plus I got a bunch of broken toes that I literally have to tape before I train. Mm-hmm. So I walk around in these flip flops constantly and I'm like, man, am I like, what if I had to fight right now? What if, you know, what's that going to look like for me? I'd way rather be having shoes. Would you like, how often do you wear flip flops, and would you wear flip flops in one of these situations, knowing that it could affect an outcome of a conflict?
I would like to take this moment to thank my sponsor for these flip-flops. Thank you, Toehold.
You're sponsored by Toehold, eh? So,
yes. So
what are those?
So let me
grand?
Just say this. First of all, just slightly under. So thank you, AG. But so here's the deal. The deal is that in most of Latin America, because of the heat, and most of the Middle East, because of the heat, they wear flip-flops. So most people wear flip-flops. Tactically, it's a horrible idea. It's really, really bad, as you noted, to get caught, because you don't have much connection to them. They're not a great platform to fight from. But the good thing for you is if you're doing something like jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai, your feet will have much more conditioning than most people. And short of being on 120-degree asphalt, you'll be able to take short periods of exposure, short of, you know, boiling liquids turning or coming onto your feet. You know, it's not that bad. So it depends on where you're at and what's going on. Certainly I'd rather be fighting in shoes than in flip-flops. But like you said, part of our culture, jiu-jitsu culture, is wearing flip-flops all the time because of ease of going on and off the mats or into a ring or whatever, wherever you're training. So there's that plus the local culture, and the places that we've been talking about are warm climates where a large percentage of the population wear flip-flops, right? So if you go, you think about, like, most of the guys are not wearing Toeholds. They're wearing some Brazilian rubber flip-flop, right? Like, you see that everywhere you go. And I just spent last year, like 3.5 months in Brazil working. And I would say 80% of the people were wearing them, short of business people, right? So it depends. But yes, I agree. Tactically, it's not a sound decision to wear flip-flops. But in terms of ease and comfort of moving in and out and around mats, and, you know, most of the guys that I know, they don't wear shoes in their house. If they wear anything, they have like internal house flip-flops that they use. You're doing like a cost benefit analysis, right? Am I going to a spot where I think I'm going to have to fight? I probably don't want to wear flip flops, right? But in reality, most of us aren't thinking that way. I think that, you know, what we do, flip flops are probably okay to wear, and especially really nice ones.
How would you rate Toehold flip flops? Are they awesome?
They're great, man. They're really, they're first of all, you know, they have Vibram soles, so they're not like normal flip-flops. The soles can take a beating. You can walk 20, 30 miles in them, tear them up. There's not going to be uneven ridges in them. You know, I'll show you. They're just, they're, these have about 100 miles on them and all kinds of stuff. And these are like a black stingrays. These guys take a beating. I beat the hell out of them. I'll go outside and, you know, be cutting down trees and, you know, starting fires, wood fires outside and doing all kinds of stuff, and they're fine. Now, tactically, it doesn't make them any more sound, but in terms of just, you know, durability, they're great. They're kind of harder to get used to from the beginning because most people are used to like really spongy, soft flip-flops, mm-hmm. and these are not built that way. These are built for durability and long-lasting. But it's pretty cool, the ridges on these. These are like a black eel. It's almost like a foot massage when you wear them, right? Because they're these little bumps along the way. But I like them. They're good things. They're not just flash.
All right, there you go, Toehold. There's your free plug on the podcast. Send me a pair if you can. Size 11.
Really nice ones. What size again?
I'm a size 11. I'm a there short go, dude AG. With kind of bigger feet, kind of like a duck. Okay, let's switch topics to your security firm. Let's talk about that. First of all, why did you get started in like protection?
It was natural, right? It was natural because I was a Marine and I was doing that kind of stuff. And what happened for me, I ended up, I don't know if you know where Marines are stationed, but on the West Coast, we go to Camp Pendleton. And I was at Camp Pendleton in Southern California. So right between San Diego and LA is this massive swath of land, which is Camp Pendleton, Orange County. And just north is where Orange County is. I ended up getting some jobs from some people that were going down to Mexico because I'm a Spanish speaker. So I went down there to translate, to set things up, to help them organize, whether they were going on vacation or business, and I'd facilitate it for them. So it was easier for them as gringos going down to have this guy, yep, this is the hotel, this is the route, this is where you're going, what you're doing. So I started doing that on the side. And then while I was there, I was training at Hixson's. And a guy came in and started training with us, literally a guy Ritchie. And once he started dating Madonna, then he had a kid with Madonna. And I picked up Madonna as a client. And, you know, Guy wanted a security guy on the team that knew jiu-jitsu. So I was training him as we were traveling around the world on tour with Madonna. And then once, you know, like anything, you get a big person on your resume, then other big artists want you. And so we started developing it that way. So then we went back to the government side of things and started doing stuff for local, state, federal governments. And it kind of just snowballed, right? Like you stumbled into this thing. And then I ended up going to start a SWAT team for a local police department and then got a commission and started working with all kinds of agencies. So that kind of progression for me was natural, right? Starting at a young age in the military and then kind of just keep along those lines. People correlate fighting with protection, and there's not any correlation really, because if I'm in the fight, that means someone's taking my client, right? So there's no real correlation. Being big, there's no correlation between being big and a protector or being big and a fighter either. But people correlate it. So I got work because I had the fighting skills as well. And so all the things that I had been doing are what people thought a protector should do. So I kept getting work. And then, as you know, as you do it longer, you get more experience, and then more experience, more clients, and more clients, more experience. And it just kind of keeps snowballing. And now I'm 30 years in, and we're still doing all that stuff. So we're doing celebrities and dignitaries. We're doing, you know, governmental entities. So 80% of my business is music tours and films, and 20% is kind of a mix of executives and dignitaries and governmental bodies. And some of that is training, some of that is protection work itself. But, you know, you see, even with some of the clients that I have, some of them have started training jiu-jitsu, and some have been doing it for a long time. Some of the clients have been doing jiu-jitsu for more than 30 years. So, it's cool to kind of blend all these worlds together, but that was my start. My start was in the military and working down in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And, your company is called Tour Protection, correct?
So our website is Tour Protection. A lot of people in the business refer to us as Tour Protection because we're tourprotection.com. But it's Close Protection Group is the formal name of the company.
Cool. Can you identify to me a mentor that you've had in life? It could be in the military. It could be for protection services. It could be for jiu-jitsu. Or even like when you were a kid, like who is a big mentor for you and what kind of qualities did they bring that really, you know, made you who you are?
I had a guy, well, first of all, my father was a great man, right? So he's no longer with us, but he was a great mentor. He led by example, not a lot of words, a lot of doing, a lot of action, and a lot of self-sacrifice. So that was by far my greatest mentor. But when you kind of talk about my lifestyle and in the jobs that I do and the history that I have, there is a guy who I started training with 94 timeframe, who was a Japanese jiu-jitsu guy, a Kyokushin karate guy, and a retired police officer, a former Marine. So all the things that I had already, you know, been on the path to, he had done. And I was training with him bare knuckle karate and Japanese jiu-jitsu. And he was always super open-minded, saying, you should try this, you should try that. He was never closed off. It was never, you know, my way is the only way. You know, always looking to get better. He was always, check this out, see if we can take something from this and put it into our system. And, you know, he was very straightforward, probably didn't have a lot of friends because he would tell people how it was. And I respected that about him. He didn't play around. He didn't, you know, put on kid gloves when he dealt with people. He told them how it was all the time. And you knew kind of where you stood and if you were doing good or bad. And, you know, he's 80 years old now. So, you know, his time's passed, but, he's been a great mentor to me for 35 ish years. And, those are the kind of things that, you know, I look for in friends and people that I do business with. And it's not common anymore. It's extremely uncommon. What that guy said is what he did. And he never deviated from that ever.
You're saying it's uncommon for people to do what they say?
Yeah, I think I'll give you an example. I was talking today with a friend of mine. He's a Henry Aikens black belt. So Henry was my roommate in LA when I was training at Hickson's. And I was talking to one of his black belts who's out of this country. And we were talking about subject matter experts, right? Like everybody in America and everybody now in 2024 is a subject matter expert, but they don't really have that experience. They say all these things, right? Like, I'm going to teach you how to be, you know, this great gunfighter, but I've never been in a gunfight. I'm going to teach you how to be this great MMA fighter and this great jiu-jitsu competitor, but I've never actually sparred even in jiu-jitsu or boxing or wrestling. You get all these guys that watch YouTube, that they listen to what people are saying and they parrot it or replicate it. And they don't have the bona fide credentials of actually having done it. And that's not to say that you can't coach if you haven't done something, but to really understand it, you know, you at least want to be able to have said you've done something, like in terms of teaching jiu-jitsu, like you should have sparred, right? It's not just drilling techniques, because when you get resistance or you're under stress, things change, as you know, right? And then you got to work it out. So I think that's the thing with him, that he taught from a place of experience, right? He taught from reality, right? Hey, that's awesome. And we should strive to have, you know, clean technique and make it work this way, but it's never going to be that way. It's not going to function that way. Like, it's going to go this way or that way. And you need solutions. And here are some ways to look at that. Here are some ways to deal with it and expect problems. And here's how you're going to deal with them. And he was a pragmatic guy, right? Very, very pragmatic, very, very reality driven. Like, as we talked about, I'm focused on submissions, and I still see jiu-jitsu, even though it's not good for competition, I still see jiu-jitsu as a fight, as a martial art, meaning the martial side is there, right? Not just the art side or the sport side. And he was super, super focused on that. Probably one of the most consistent people, like day in and day out. Good day, bad day, he behaved the same way, right? Even if he was in a shitty spot. So that's kind of what I'm referencing. I don't see a lot of that now. I don't see that grit that older class had, right? Those guys were just a different breed. And I think the circumstances helped to make that. He was a special person, but on top of that, the circumstances made a harder human.
For your protection agency, how many guys do you have working under you? You had mentioned that you're in like over 100 countries.
So how that exactly, so we're over 151 right now, but how that works is we have guys that work for us as employees, and then we have guys that work for us as 1099 contractors. And then we have overseas guys, right? Who, let's say, work for another company, right? So let's say Canada, for example, I can't carry a firearm in Canada. And so let's say I had a higher threat protection detail, and let's say the Canadian government didn't want to support it for whatever reason, but I have a friend who's, retired from JTF2 and he has all the permits and licensing, then I would subcontract him and he would work in the detail with us. So that's how that works overseas. We will subcontract guys who are not direct employees of the company. And then in the US, we obviously have both employees and 1099 for you, if you don't know, is like hired guns, right? That work with you, but aren't an employee of the company.
Are they mercenaries? Or agents?
I think that depends on how.
What would you call them from a layman?
It depends on how you define. Yeah, it depends on how you define mercenaries. Like in the States and Canada, and more of the common place is what you're calling a mercenary, like a contractor, a security contractor, wouldn't be necessary unless the threat was high. And usually those threats come from mostly ideological places, right? Meaning religion or politics. And we have some of those, right? So, we have a client who's speaking out on his position, pro-Palestine, anti-Israel. It's not a popular position. He's speaking out pro-Russia, anti-Ukraine, not a popular position. And so we have to manage that and deal with that. And so the level of guy that we have and the assets that we have and the planning and coordinating, that changes relative to the threat level. And so depending on what they're talking about, what they're doing, how big the platform they're speaking from is, that changes. And then also the location. So for example, we were talking about, war zones. You're talking about the Middle East. If we're doing something in northern Iraq or Syria or somewhere in that region, yes, more likely than not, we will use what you're calling a mercenary, right? Guys that come out of the military that only work in that high threat protective operations environment. And so those guys will augment our team or could even potentially lead it depending on how the team is structured and where we're going and what we're doing. So sometimes, yes, if it's appropriate, yes, right?
How often are you in the field? Or are you mostly focused on the administrative side of this? Or do you like to still get in the field and be the guy right there?
Yeah, the unfortunate answer is I'm in the field a lot. And prior to COVID, I was kind of working my way out, and then things changed for us. The dynamic changed for us. COVID happened and guys got to stay home for the first time in many, many years. And they're like, I don't want to do this anymore. That's a crazy job. And I like to sleep in my own bed and I want a more stable kind of 9-to-5. And so we had to do a lot of restructuring, post COVID. So I'm back out in the field more often than I was before, but with age, obviously, hopefully that's tapering off over the next 10 years to the point where when I'm 60, I'm not in the field at all. But I'm still doing, the vast majority of admin and logistics and relationships and coordination and facilitating things like that. So unfortunately, I'm on both sides of it. And I'm running the business and I'm in the business at the same time.
What side of the business do you prefer, being the administrative or being in the field?
If I was a young guy, I would want to do all field work. And as I get older, with injuries, it depends. I don't want to sit home. I don't want to be static. That doesn't work for me. It's just like tapering a jiu-jitsu workout, right? How old are you?
36. I have injuries.
Yeah, so you're in the prime, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You got injuries, but you're in your prime where your mind and your body are coming together. True. Right? You're not stupid anymore like you were when you were 26, and your body's not as hurt as it's going to be in 15 or 20 years. And so you're kind of at that sweet spot. Now it's going to start to go the other way, right? So somewhere around now, you lose 2-3% of your testosterone a year. Those old injuries will come back that you thought, you know, you had conquered. You know, you'll get new injuries easier. You'll wake up, you'll step out of bed and, you know, twist your ankle or, you know, tear your MCL or your meniscus and, you know, stuff like that. So as that happens, it doesn't mean you're not a warrior anymore, that you don't want to fight anymore, that, you know, it's just now you're going to be needing to have more time to recover.
It's time to get on test, basically, is what you're saying.
Listen, I tell you what, if you go to IBJJF and you compete and you see the dudes my age that are yoked, and that's not me, I'm on nothing. And I think that is a bit problematic now, because when you're the only dude, no, I shouldn't say only, when you're in the low percentage group of guys who aren't on anything, you know, you're at a distinct disadvantage. The problem is, if you're going to have to do something for life, I kind of like to start it later. You know, you see the benefits of it, but once that starts, it's very hard to go backwards. You're going to have to keep kind of going down that path. And whether it's from a biological standpoint of putting, you know, synthetic stuff in, or if it's from a financial standpoint of spending the money on it, you know, I don't know, but I think that needs to wait a little bit for me. And I know most guys don't agree with me, whether it's in my gym or at tournaments, it's, you see it. It's very clear that the trend is, you know, you're doing testosterone and HGH, and some of the guys, even my age, I see are doing like Winstrol and steroids. Like, man, that seems late in the game to be doing that kind of stuff or putting in your body.
There's a difference between getting absolutely yoked to go win a tournament and just using it as like a therapeutic supplement for an aging person who, you know, like my mind with PEDs has gone, and I've been on both sides with my opinions and my look at it. But like at the end of the day, if you're a soldier or if you are a professional martial artist, you know, like, if you're a gym owner and you have like young guys coming after you or whatever, and you just want to give them good training, and you know, you're not like a 20-year-old who's hitting the test super hard and trying to just go win tournaments.
That's not even your opinion.
It's a difference.
What you're saying is a fact. What you're saying is a scientific fact. It's that simple. I'm just saying that I want to delay that if I can, and I'm still able to compete, and I'm still able to make the podium. I'm still able to go and work 20-hour days, 6-7 days. Days a week, and I'm still able to do all these things. I'm just going to be more tired, more injured, and more worn out. And you're going to see my eyes are red, and it's not from smoking weed. You know, you're going to notice these things. You're going to feel it. I don't think it's wrong. You know, if you look at sports, people, spectators, they want that high performance level. And I'm from St. Louis, and you know, we're a baseball town. And when Mark McGwire started smacking those home runs, he was doing everything under the sun. And you know, you saw it with Sammy Sosa, and then you saw it with, you know, the A's and that whole kind of system they had set up. So I'm not saying people shouldn't or don't, but you know, if you didn't have a 900 testosterone level, you know, in your prime, if you were 500 testosterone and then now, you know, you're 60 and you have 900 testosterone, you know, for me, it's like, okay, that's not therapy. That's not, you know, hormone replacement to get you to a normal level. Mm. And I think that the downside is there are probably consequences long-term for that. Again, I think everybody should do what they want. I really do. I'm not telling people they shouldn't do it. Some guys, you know, they live at 60 years old to be a competitor, a jiu-jitsu competitor. And if that keeps them doing the thing they love, more power to them. I'm just talking about me. So when I say, hey, it's not right for me, I just mean for me. I'm not suggesting some other person doesn't do it. Like everything, you know, the choices that we make have consequences. And so you just have to know what they are. And if you say, hey man, I'm good with the consequences from 65 until I die, so long as I can be a champion from 60 to 65, cool. No problem. I get it. You know, each person kind of values something differently. And, in my case, I have to do a lot of different things. It's not just jujitsu. So, you know, I'm trying to slow things down as opposed to, you know, speed things up in my case.
Can you just briefly talk about like the training process for the people whom you employ, for your protection agency? Like, can you, you know, how, yeah. given any given situation, how would you adjust like the tactics and the techniques that you would teach? What qualities are you looking for people, and sort of what is like a loose guideline as to your training approach?
Well, let's start chronologically, kind of how we would address it. So you're asking about the people first off. So I'm looking for guys that have some type of background where they've endured some type of hardship, and yet they have a very stable baseline of behavior, right? So a personality profile comes into play. You know, I've got to have a guy that can work long days, right? You're going to have to work a lot of times 6 to 7 days a week, on average, 18 to 20 hours a day. That already gets rid of most people in 2024, right? So I don't care if they can fight. I don't care, you know, that they're a tough guy or they're big. None of that matters. So we look at the baseline personality profile. How do they deal with adversity? If something is a challenge, will they quit or will they push through it? Again, kind of going back to the very beginning of our conversation, that was one of the main values of jiu-jitsu, right? Someone puts you down. It's not like you quit. They put you down and you fight. Now I'm trying to sweep them. Now I'm trying to submit them. It's not over and I don't stop until the round's over, right? So same thing. You need somebody with a strong mindset. We tend to see that athletes do well, right? They deal with adversity because they're used to that kind of stuff. Wrestlers do great in my field, very, very well. We see more football players because they're big and people hire big people, but not in my particular group. So we look for that. We're looking for a baseline of behavior. We're looking for people that can operate very well under stress. We're looking for people that are able to analyze problems, right? They're able to analyze an environment, right? So they're looking at somebody saying problem, analysis, solution, and they're able to implement it. We're looking for people that have the ability to work in diverse environments, right? So you're going to work with one extreme group of people and then another extreme group of people. And you're going to have to be able to potentially take life, and you're going to have to be able to potentially save it or deal with somebody's children, you know? So you're going to have to be different people at different times in the job. So that personality profile is number one. Then we put them into, you know, training phases, and we review them during the training, and then their peers review them during the training. And then we constantly throw curveballs at them during the training, right? Like, hey, we're going to do this and we're going to break for dinner. Now, let's say they've been doing an 18-hour day and they think they get a 2-hour dinner, and then bam, we snatch the dinner from them and they don't get that. And now they haven't eaten all day. They're tired. You know, it's 35 degrees outside. They're cold. And we see how they handle that. How do they manage that? How do they manage their emotions? How do they manage the physical aspects of it? You know, how do they push through stuff, or how do they quit? Then how does that relate to the group, right? Are they still able to keep their function within the group and achieve their mission even when those circumstances are less than ideal? So in training focuses a lot on environments, a lot on behaviors, a lot on watching people, a lot on understanding what's important and kind of categorizing certain things, right? We get distracted a lot in life with these things that are really unimportant relative to our mission. And then our attention gets pulled somewhere and our energy gets pulled somewhere. So we get to see kind of who values the right things, especially in unclear circumstances, where it's not like I'm telling you, hey, A is most important, B is... You're able to do that on your own, right? So very unclear, kind of murky gray areas. Are they able to make order out of chaos? That's the first kind of phase of training. Then we teach them, if they get through that, admin and logistics, how to structure things, how to coordinate things, who to rely on for things, how to build teams, how to deal with the logistics of, you know, air and ground and sea and hotels and venues and different cultures and all of those kinds of things. And then if they get through that, then we go into kind of what we call hard skills. All the previous would be soft skills. And the hard skills would be shooting and fighting and driving and stuff like that, breaching maybe. And then we, if they get through that, then we go kind of back into a softer skill, which would be doing assessments, right? Threat assessments and vulnerability assessments and risk assessment. So if you have $1 million that you get to spend on security, you know, how are you going to spend that $1 million? Where's the money going? And, you know, how do you value things? And then if you're doing a threat assessment, you know, relative to that person, relative to the realm, the history of both of those things together, what your capabilities are in defending things, you'll build this threat assessment. Then you look at a vulnerability assessment saying, what are my vulnerabilities? You know, what is my weakness? Let's say I have this really, robust pass structure or credential structure for this protected venue or building. But I know I have this crackhead who's going to take that pass that gets them everywhere. They're going to go out to smoke, prop the door open, have a smoke, and somebody's going to exchange that credential to get them in, and they're going to get on their face alone. That person becomes the liability. Or let's say you have a drinking problem or a drug problem or a gambling problem or a problem with prostitutes or, you know, a problem with your wife or your kids, then you become the vulnerability to the team. So then we work through that kind of phase. So once we start to stack all these blocks, these building blocks together, we have a good idea of if a guy will work or won't work. And then the last kind of bit of training we do before they actually go full-time on their own is we put them into what they call OJT or on-the-job training. And we'll put them as like a third man on a three-man team or a fifth man on a five-man team. And they're kind of like the assistants, almost an apprenticeship. And we'll see how they work with the team members under stress in a real environment. Let's say it's entertainment and they're next to some really high profile people. They're flying around on private jets. They're staying at the Four Seasons. You know, are they kissing the ass of the rock star or the movie star and wanting to get in photos and talking to TMZ, or are they doing what they should be doing? And so we'll test them that way. Right. So it's rather complex and it's done over time. And depending on their level, it can be something as short as 3 weeks or something as long as 3 years to get them through the pipeline.
Do you overlook all the training?
Yeah, have to. It ultimately, you know, I'm going to be the one that pays the price if they're not right for the job, which happens from time to time, because you know, with humans, you're going to err, they're going to err. You're going to want to see something, you know, oh yeah, I really like this guy. He was great at jujitsu. He's great with kids. He's great with planning. And then all of a sudden, you know, you don't realize some factor of his life that there was no way to see. You know, a lot of times you can look at, let's say you look at a credit score. Let's say you look at a criminal record. That doesn't tell me certain things, certain weaknesses that you have. And maybe the job that I'm sending you to is the thing that sets them off. And I have to know that. And the only way to really know that, if I'm looking at all the factors after we do a background on you and everything looks good, and then you look good in training, you look good on OJT. But then when you get out there and you fatigue quickly on your own because you don't have the team to hold you up, and then you start doing stuff that is not good for us, it's not good for you. But I wouldn't know that until you're out there on your own fatiguing, right? And then your true colors kind of come out. And you see that too, like with what you do, you see guys who are like gym heroes, but they crush under pressure when it's time for tournaments, right? Like they smoke everybody in the room. They're smoking world champions, but they go to compete and they can't make the podium ever because they panic or they just can't manage it. So we need to find that out as much as we can on the front end. And then there are other factors too that you see in a gym that we deal with, which are kind of the cancers, right? People that poison the well. Like they come in and you have people that lift up the gym and make the team better and are doing all kinds of stuff to support the team and the gym and going out of their way, giving a disproportionate amount of time and energy and money to the gym. And you have the others that just suck energy out of the gym. And so if we start to recognize that with our guys early on, we get rid of them because that type of cancer metastasize and it's detrimental to your business as it would be to your gym.
Great. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I will anyways. Is there like a, you know, in any of the professions that you've been in, whether it's mixed martial arts or being a Marine or, you know, your protection services, can you share a story from the field? Any that stick out to you?
Those are harder just because we have non-disclosure agreements that are pretty strict and I want to keep working in our business. So the more we disclose, the more problematic they are. But you know, we've had some really extreme things where, you know, we've had artists decide to go play in a war zone and then, you know, be taken kind of hostage. You got a dozen guys with AKs pointed at you and you're trying to manage, you know, effectively a release of the guys. And that kind of stuff is pretty extreme and it doesn't happen frequently. Other times where, you know, we're literally run off the road and in up armored vehicles and dealing with the State Department, getting support to come and pull us out of a place. Other times where literally, you know, I've had challenge matches from other guys that were supposed to be working in the same profession as us in front of a client, and then have a client throw it on their bags and like, nope, do it. Go ahead. Have your thing. I'm going to watch here while this guy gets his medicine.
But they want to see a fight.
You get these very, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can, there are guys that have talked about this. I think, you know, in my realm, because of jujitsu, probably not our biggest client, not even close, but Tool is one of our clients, and Maynard trains jujitsu. And so, you know, people know because I've been training him for a long time.
Just,
so is Henry.
Just want to say, sorry to interrupt, probably my favorite band. Fucking love Tool.
Uh-oh.
They're so awesome.
But, you know, he's one of the guys, you know, Maynard's talked about this before. He's been there when dudes have called me out and like, how are you going to protect him? Look how small you are. And, you know, I'm trying to leave. He's like, no, just handle it. You know, just handle it and put his stuff down. I want to watch, you know, this big, huge dude that thinks he's going to get a piece, and you got to solve the problem. And so, you know, managing liability of that is a whole nother conversation, but you know, we get pretty extreme stuff. We have a client who says, you know what, we're going to Syria and I'm doing this thing and we're going to this camp to rescue these children. And, oh, but you don't understand. We got to get through this entire war zone of people. I'm like, no, you can't go. We got to go do it for you. So we have, pretty extreme things. And, you know, we have, we've had clients that, had passed away, and they've wanted to hire guards to watch a body, like literally stand next to a body for X amount of time, and very, very different situations. You know, we deal with stuff where a high profile person may want to put a security guy on a jet, fly him halfway across the world to get a diamond or a watch. You know, like go pick up that $500,000 watch. Like, put one guy, a security guy, on a G5. And, you know, send them on this trip that's maybe 75, 100 grand just for the flight to and from, pick up a $500,000 watch and bring it back. So you have all these weird kind of things. And I, you know, obviously can't say who it is or where it is unless, you know, they've talked about it like Maynard. But it's just abnormal, a lot of abnormal circumstances. We spend a lot of time in the equivalent of a White House dealing with really high level people. You know, we have, you know what challenge coins are? We'll have challenge coins, and we will negotiate a border crossing where they won't let us through a border with something as simple as a challenge coin. Look, this is not mine. This is a Marine's from a Marine's protect the inside of U.S. embassies. It's called MSG duty. So like where I go places, you know, we'll make these exchanges. So this one happens to be from Japan. I'm just showing you this one because it's in front of me, but you know, we'll exchange this thing that we have for something that's, you know, thinking about getting across a border where they've closed a border between two countries, and something as simple as a piece of metal with a celebrity's, you know, logo on it or a military group's logo on it. I'll grab some, like, you know, something like this, right? From the WBC. This is a gift from the president of the WBC, Mauricio Suleiman, but something like this will get you access to something that you would never otherwise think you could do. You think about Canada or the US, and you know, there's no chance you're getting into the White House, for example, or a presidential palace, but some small thing that an hourly wage guard never had access to is trading you now access to something for it. So, you know, I don't know over 30 years what crazy stuff has happened in its totality, but like those little things happen nonstop, and you become very reflective, like this is not a normal life.
Mm-hmm. How often do things get dicey in the field? Or would you say that like the majority of operations run smoothly?
Well, I would say that the majority of operations do not run smoothly because there are people involved. And so anytime you have people, you have problems, you have personalities, you have egos, ours and theirs, usually it's the clients. And so you have hiccups and things never go as planned. I shouldn't say never, but very, very rarely go as planned. However, in terms of life or death, those instances are not common. It's more of a nuisance, more of trying to access information or access to a person or leverage a person. And then, you know, let's say it's 3% of the time, then it's a lethal threat. So we're managing at any given time, you know, what you would call a restraining order. They're called orders of protection against people, against violent people. So when are they going to jail? When are they getting out of jail? Are they in the area? Are we going to be in the area where they live? You know, can we make communication with their parents or, you know, their loved one to see what their status is? We can't find them. We would call that in the wind. They're in the wind. That's a problem. So we deal with all kinds of things, but in terms of like running and gunning, like we're getting into fights all the time and shootouts, that's not normal. And so when you see that kind of thing, it's not realistic. You know, I would say 1-3% of the time you're dealing with something that is potentially lethal. And, you know, 97-99% of the time, it's more admin and logistics and ego and personality and finances and things like that. But again, it depends on where you're at. So as the person that you're with is higher risk, the more problems you have. As the region that you go to is higher risk, the more problems. And now you start to cross those factors over, right? Where you have a high profile person saying crazy things or extreme things, and then you go to a volatile environment like a war zone. Now you have some problems, right? And then you have the other problem on my side, the biggest problem, which is coming from the inside. All of the people on the inside that have any piece of information, that's a potential leak for us. And most of the problems come from information leaking out. So trying to keep that secure is probably one of the greatest challenges that we have in this day and age, right? Because you have a cell phone and all it takes is somebody capturing a photo and shooting it out. Or what's more common and even worse is your client who you're protecting. You know, they're on the penthouse suite of the whatever hotel in whatever country, and they're taking photos from their balcony. Not only are they exposed physically by being on the balcony, but for the people that don't see them, now when they post it on Instagram or Twitter or whatever, now they see the surroundings and go, oh yeah, that's the X hotel. So now they're giving away their position. Or you have a worker who wants to be identified as somebody belonging to that group because it gives them some type of power status. And they say, oh yeah, I work for Madonna. Oh yeah, I'm double. And now, you know, you're compromised from that perspective because they're telling people where they are and when they're moving and who they're related to. And bad guys are trying to pick up the pieces, like which people work for them, who's the weakest link, who can we exploit to get the thing that we want? How do we learn when they're coming out of the front door or when they're coming out of the garage or when they're coming out the back or the service entrance or whatever? Well, this one assistant, you know, wants attention and, you know, you name it, whatever it is. Like maybe she doesn't get attention from guys, and this guy that's very attractive is giving her attention, and now she's giving up information in exchange for that. So managing that is probably more of the job than, you know, running and gunning where you're shooting and fighting and, you know, people are chasing you. So that and kind of crowd control aspects when you deal with large bands or boy bands, things like that, where you've got, you know, 5,000 little girls outside screaming, that actually is more challenging than going into a war zone sometimes.
Hmm. Just a couple more questions here. What's your biggest accomplishment in life?
Man, I don't know the answer to that. I keep trying to push the envelope with what I get done in the time that I have on Earth. And I keep trying to push stuff out. So I'm constantly trying to continue to compete, continue to learn, continue to mentor people, continue to, you know, grow my company, continue to write books. I'm trying to continue to learn new languages, learn stuff. So I don't know if I can pinpoint one thing, but, you know, from the outside looking in, you know, you maybe people would say my business or competing or teaching or whatever, but I don't feel like I've got to that point yet, because I'm kind of assessing it from the totality of it as opposed to one singular achievement. I have a think about that one and come back to you on that. But I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
What's your favorite, or who is your favorite grappler?
Right now, like if we're talking about gi jiu-jitsu, right now I kind of like, and his style's not like mine, but I kind of like watching Adam Wardzinski. Mm-hmm. Like I enjoy watching his style because it's different than mine, but it is pretty basic. It is pretty predictable. And I like the fact that he's doing these things. The guy knows it's going to come and he can't do anything about it, which reminds me of training with Hickson. Cause when I would train with Hickson, I knew everything that he was doing. I just couldn't stop anything that he was doing, right? He wasn't doing anything fancy. It was straightforward. And I like that, you know, back in the day, you know, I used to like to watch Frank Mir because he was doing jiu-jitsu in MMA, and I could appreciate that. And that's kind of how I felt about, you know, SWAT stuff or Marine stuff or protective stuff. I was applying the concepts and principles of jiu-jitsu in a different sort of way. I wasn't doing fancy stuff. I wasn't doing crazy stuff, but you know, it's cool to watch Gordon. You know, he's phenomenal. All these guys are great. The only thing I'm not into, is super complex moves where it takes like 10 steps to get somewhere, because for us and what I do, each connecting point is a point of potential failure. So the longer that chain is, the more likely something is to go wrong. And we could be talking about information, right? Because if I give information to one guy and it transfers from me to that person, I have an exposure. Then if I give it to three guys, okay, one, two, three, each point is a potential exposure or it goes wrong. Even if I'm talking about physical stuff like getting out of a car and walking into a hotel, getting, you know, from the hotel to the car, from the car to the airport out of the car into the jet. Those are points of exposure. And so with jiu-jitsu, you think about those, the long chains for me are not good because they don't work when you have gear on, when you have weapons, when you have these stressors. So any of the guys that are able to do stuff in two or three or four kind of movements in a chain or sequence that's short, those are the guys I like watching a lot.
What is your favorite thing to do?
Sit in the sun and drink a coffee is probably amongst one of my favorite things to do. If I can sit in the sun, drink a coffee, and be by the ocean, that made me pretty happy.
What's the best advice you have ever been given?
Man, it's a great question. That's a great question. Probably for business and life, the same guy that I was mentioning was saying a lot of people are going to tell you they can't. You know, they're thinking in terms of them. They don't know what you're capable of. You don't even know what you're capable of. Don't listen to other people. If you decide you're going to do it, do it. And, you know, if you fail, so what? Stand back up, do it again. You know, basically in a nutshell, don't listen to other people is the gist of it. Like if you really want something, don't listen to other people. And one of the things that he used to say, and this is 30 years ago, don't tell people what you're going to do. Just go do it. Because if you tell them, you know, they can put up roadblocks and hurdles because maybe they don't want to see you succeed. And that's not everybody. There's some people that will help kind of hold you up or lift you up. But, you know, he said, go after it, do it, as hard and fast and as good as you can do it. And don't worry about it. You fail, get up, keep going. That's been true in everything. I've had tons of people say, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it's not true. And it wasn't even that those people were being malicious and saying that I couldn't do something. It's just that they didn't know better, right? It's like taking advice from someone about going somewhere that they've never been. They've never left the house, and yet they want to tell you how it is in another realm or another place. That's probably the best piece of advice I have. Just if you want to do it, push it, go all the way. I don't think it's so profound, but, you know, a lot of times we're influenced by people telling us, no, that's not achievable. And that person doesn't have any frame of reference for saying that because they've never done that or tried to do it.
Last question. What is the strangest or wildest thing that's ever happened to you in jiu-jitsu or something that you've seen in jiu-jitsu? Again, putting you on the spot with all these questions.
No. That's a little bit easier because, you know, in the mid 90s when the Brazilians were coming here and were just starting, and when I was just starting with jiu-jitsu, I didn't know what normal was, right? So like, if you don't have a baseline for normal, you expect whatever they're doing is just, that's how it operates in that particular realm. And my instructor, you know, had just received his black belt. He had been black belt maybe 6 months or something when he came, and he kind of applied the Brazilian methodology and logic and culture to what we did and how we did it. And guys would come in and they would have an attitude, and this was kind of normal in America in martial arts school at the time. And they would have challenges, and you shut the door, lock the door, and then you just keep choking them out and whatever, and smash them up a little bit. And then it went to the next level, which was the first and kind of end of the era that I was exposed to, which was dojo storming, right? Taking a whole group of guys and going to another gym and smashing them because they talked about you, right? So there was I don't even know if this gym still exists, but our gym had a thing back in the day, and this was, again, mid-90s. There was a ninjutsu school. It was called the Missouri Bunjikan Ninjutsu School. And there was a guy named Ken Harding who was running this school, and he's telling these guys they're ninja warriors, and they wore like black toed shoes, and they, you know, dressed up like ninjas. And it was a bona fide school, like people paid to train there. And one of the students came to train at our gym and said, "These guys were saying this about you." Now, anybody else would have been like, "Yeah, whatever. I don't give a shit what they say." But my coach was like, "What? Buddy, they talk about us, buddy. Gonna go smash, buddy. Tell him we come to the gym. We're gonna go to the gym. We're gonna smash a fist. This guy don't know what about to happen to him, buddy." And you know, everybody gets in a car. Everybody goes to the gym. Everybody smashes those guys. And the instructor, this guy Ken, told everybody that we were all black belts dressed up in white belts. And the truth was, it was just white belts who had been training for like 6 months that smashed the shit out of these ninjutsu students. I think a lot of the stuff that was happening in the mid-90s, you know, when the Brazilian jiu-jitsu scene really kind of just started here, you'd probably go to jail for now.
So are you, when you say
that would work out too
when
well.
You're talking about challenge matches, are you referring to like, no, we're having a no holds barred fight?
Yeah, but it wasn't like a sanctioned fight, and it wasn't like fans were there. People would come in and be like, "I'm a champion at this, I'm a champion at that," you know, and they would say stuff like, "I want to train with you." Well, my coach at the time, his English wasn't good. So "I want to train with you" kind of felt like a challenge, and it might have been. I don't know. If you didn't smile at him at the time, he thought everything was a challenge, right? Because he didn't have any way to judge. Because if you're not smiling, that means it's aggressive. But a lot of guys came in. I mean, I'm talking about a dozen dudes over the course of a handful of years. And you know, this is even post UFC. This might be a couple years, 2 years after the UFC started. And guys just didn't see it, whether it was judo or kung fu or tai chi or whatever silly thing they did. They would come in, they would make their claims, and he'd be like, "Okay," and he'd shut the door, lock it, and then be like, "Go with this guy." And you know, guys are getting choked out and jacked up, and you know, they would leave with their tails between their legs. It was just a very different approach. I mean, I think now, just from a liability perspective, like thinking about the ramifications of that occurring 30 years later, it would not work at all. And the criminal side is kind of harder to judge, but the civil side is definitely an exposure. Those times were, to me, in retrospect, kind of wild times. There were a lot of fights, a lot of aggressive stuff that just, time specific in the progression of jiu-jitsu and MMA, which was NHB. I don't know. Things are very different now, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Oh yeah. Different times for sure. Out of curiosity, did you ever see anybody from another school or another discipline come in, you know, do one of these dojo storms or challenge matches, get their ass kicked, and then be like, "I want to join you guys"? Did that ever happen?
No, you know, what's funny about that is that's the hardest part. Like, for me, I was doing the bare knuckle karate, you know, I'd been a Marine and I was doing all this stuff. And when I came in, my first experience, was with a 15-year-old kid who was like 150 pounds and he tooled me up. Like he triangled me in the first minute and a half of that. And again, I was a wrestler and a bare knuckle karate guy. And it took so much for me to come back the next day and then to get tooled up again. It was like a couple months before I started getting good at defending, and then a couple more months before I was good at attacking. But it's very hard for people to swallow their pride. And I can't think off the top of my head anybody where they just got served and then they're like, "Okay, I'm, you know, take it like a man, I'm going." You know, when I think about stories like that, I can't think of anybody from that perspective, but there was one guy who was probably the exception to the rule. In all of my time in jiu-jitsu, I've never seen anybody that couldn't grow, like from what they are to just something better, right? Like even if you're not going to be a champion, you're still going to get better than what you started at. And there was one guy during this era named Pablo, and Pablo Pablo, you know how you have waves in jiu-jitsu, how you have like, you come in and then you're just getting beat, but then there's a another group that comes in 6 months behind you or whatever, and you start to dominate them. And eventually you kind of get to the top of the school. Pablo, you know, month one, month six, 12 months, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, just getting his ass beat all the time. So for years and years, I said, you know, anybody could learn jiu-jitsu except Pablo. You know, he was the exception to the rule, the only guy I ever met that couldn't learn jiu-jitsu. And 20 years went by and Pablo shows up in my gym, and Pablo's a brown belt, competitive brown belt, winning tournaments. Something clicked and this dude changed. And he was one of the best stories in that I can think of in terms of that kind of stuff, because he was a guy always getting beat down who just stuck with it. He wasn't a dojo stormer. He trained with us the whole time, but he was a guy who just kept, I've never seen anybody just get beaten for years and years and years and years and just keep showing up. And in the 3 years that he was at our gym, man, I don't know if the guy ever won one match, like one sparring match ever. But 20 years went by and he was kicking ass because he didn't quit. So that was one of the best lessons I ever had.
That is great. I've taken a lot of your time today, Todd. I'd like to give you this moment to sort of share any, you know, social media or links. Of course, we'll include them in the show notes on the bottom, but the floor is yours.
Assuming people are watching and not listening, this is my current book. It's called Underpinning: Foundational Concepts of Force Instruction. And this book basically is designed for jiu-jitsu guys or MMA guys who are teaching law enforcement. So there's a lot that they don't know. There's a lot that they don't understand in terms of the laws, in terms of agency policy, in terms of systems and processes, in terms of gear that's worn and how that changes how you move and what you can and can't do and exposures and things like that. So this book was designed to help anybody teaching law enforcement. So now in jiu-jitsu, we've got this new fad where everybody teaches law enforcement, but yet they've never been it. They've never been in those same situations. They've never worn that gear. They don't understand the law. They don't understand the policies. And this book is designed because of that. It's there to help kind of offset that huge gap. You know, again, it would be like, I'm going into this environment to teach jiu-jitsu guys. I've seen a video, but I've never actually sparred or drilled with anybody, and I'm going to go teach jiu-jitsu. So, it doesn't work really well that way. You create a lot of liabilities. And I think this book will really change the way guys see their jiu-jitsu instruction or force instruction for law enforcement. If they read this book, it'll open up their eyes in a new way. So, really that's kind of why I'm here is to promote the book. I'm happy to talk about all the stuff we talked about. You know, it's my passion. And then another thing you and I talked a lot about today was protection based stuff, right? Thinking about things through the lens of protector, whether you're a parent or, you know, you're going on a business trip overseas or a vacation. And there's a book for that too. It's called Protection For and From Humanity. And this book is really designed to teach people systems and processes and ways to look at protection. And it could be at their workplace, it could be on a vacation, it could be at their house. It's strategies for structuring a system that works relative to survival and protection of assets and people and things like that. And so both of these were out of necessity. So those are two of my five books, but those are the two most relevant to the people that you and I would be talking to today.
Again, someone, we'll be able to edit it out. That's fine. I don't know if you heard that, someone rang in my doorbell. Great. Well, thank you so much, Todd. That was a great conversation. I learned so much. It was great picking your brain and just hearing all your experiences, all the things that you've done with your life. It's incredible. So thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me. It's good talking to you.
And it was awesome. Guys, for those who want to support the show, check out the links on the bottom. You guys know what to do. I appreciate all of you. Remember, the Everyday Jiu-Jitsu Podcast is everything you need to know about jiu-jitsu, and we're going to see you next time. Thank you.